Is there really any use to medical marijuana?
Screening for a cold cancer when someone has an unprovoked clot in the leg or the lung.
Reversing a commonly used anticoagulant.
And how do you handle the patient that's on a blood thinner but needs to have a surgical procedure?
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on June 26, 2015. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, the stories about medical marijuana have come out this week and are gathering a lot of media attention. One we're not going to talk about is one relative to, hey, what's really in those marijuana products you might be consuming. But two from the Journal of the American Medical Association are taking a look at, hey, is there really any clinical utility to this stuff?
And although cannabis and the cannabinoid drugs are really widely used to either treat disease or to alleviate symptoms, their efficacy really hasn't been studied very well. And so these investigators conducted a systematic review of both the benefits and the adverse events of cannabinoids. To do that, they looked at 28 different databases from when the databases first started to April of 2015. So this was an exhaustive search. They specifically looked for randomized clinical trials of the cannabinoids for common indications that they are currently used for, things like nausea and vomiting due to chemotherapy and appetite stimulation in people that have AIDS or HIV infection, chronic pain. They were able to identify 79 different trials involving almost 6,500 participants. Here's what they discovered. Quality of the trials overall was not very good. There appeared to be moderate quality evidence to support the use of cannabinoids for the treatment of chronic pain and spasticity, but low quality evidence to support any of the other conditions. Their use was associated with an increased risk of short-term adverse events. Now, the most common ones were dizziness, dry mouth, fatigue, somnolence, nausea, euphoria, vomiting, disorientation, drowsiness, confusion, and hallucination.
Now, of course, we're already well underway with legalizing marijuana nationally. So how do these studies, this meta-analysis, impact on that particular trend?
Well, Elizabeth, you're right. It's been legalized in 23 states and the District of Columbia, allegedly for medicinal use. What an accompanying editorialist comments is that we have very strict criteria that medications have to fulfill if the FDA is going to approve a medication for a particular condition. And none of that's been forthcoming with the use of marijuana. We need to do proper studies, randomized controlled trials sponsored by the federal government so that we can ascertain whether it is effective or it's not effective. These cannabinoids affect a particular part of the neurologic system that is particularly vulnerable in adolescents. In fact, it's developing even up to age 25. So not only do we need to randomize control trials, but we need trials looking at the long-term effects of cannabinoids as well.
But I would suggest to you that much like many of these other medications, and of course we've cited aspirin any number of times and said if it was up right now for FDA approval, it's unlikely that it would be approved. Now that this horse is out of the barn, I think getting it back in and saying, oops, there's really no efficacy here, we're going to delegalize it is very unlikely.
Well, I think you're right. This time we put the cart before the horse.
More on this, unquestionably. Let's turn to the New England Journal of Medicine. A couple of them, I thought they were both really interesting, but I think the one with the huge clinical impact is going to be dabigatran, dabigatran, a commonly used anticoagulant. How can we reverse that when we need to, which we often do?
Just to put it in perspective, we've had Coumadin as an oral anticoagulant available for decades. Recently, we've had four new oral anticoagulants become available for treating patients that have had a clot in their leg, deep vein thrombosis, or at risk of stroke because they have atrial fibrillation. And the advantages of these newer agents over Coumadin is you don't have to adjust the dose, a shorter half-life, that means it clears quicker. You don't have to monitor it with laboratory tests. They do a better job of lowering the risk of having these clots form, or they have a less risk of bleeding. So you say, well, why isn't everybody using these? Well, because we have effective ways of reversing Coumadin, but very few or no effective ways of reversing the other anticoagulants. So if someone has a serious bleeding condition, or if someone needs emergent surgery, we have no effective way of reversing those. So this particular study is important because it introduces an antibody that is directed towards the same target as dabigatran. In this study, in 90 individuals that were either having active life-threatening bleeding or needing emergent surgery, they gave two doses of this monoclonal antibody, idrisuzumab, and then asked, does it in fact reverse dabigatran? In those individuals that are having active bleeding, does it cause cessation of the bleeding? And the answer to both those questions was yes. It was effective in about 90% of individuals in reversing the hematologic or the lab results that showed that dabigatran was causing anticoagulation. And for those that had serious bleeding, and we could measure when it stopped within about 11 hours.
It is really good news. So what happened with this antibody infusion? And I'm guessing, of course, that it was an infusion.
It was two doses given 15 minutes apart. Does it promote thrombosis or clotting? Only one of the 90 individuals had a clot form within the first 3 to 4 days.
I'm going to view this as good news, cautiously optimistic that we're not going to find out that giving this is a problem down the road somewhere. So since we're talking about this kind of thing, and we're also in the New England Journal of Medicine, let's talk about the same circumstance. Okay, you've got somebody who's on anticoagulation. They're going to have an invasive procedure. Now what?
We've talked before about the fact atrial fibrillation is pretty common, and the treatment for that to prevent stroke associated with it is to give Coumadin or an anticoagulant. These individuals, about 1 in 6 who are actually on Coumadin, will either need an elective operation or an elective procedure. And therefore, what do you do with the anticoagulation? Many of these individuals receive an intravenous blood thinner, bridging anticoagulation. But the question is, do we really need it? To assess that, these investigators performed a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial in which they took people that needed an elective procedure. They either stopped Coumadin 5 days before and started it afterwards, or they stopped it, gave an intravenous blood thinner, and then started Coumadin afterwards. And what they discovered is that of the over 1,800 patients enrolled, the risk of having a clot form was very small, about 0.3 to 0.4% in both groups. However, the bridging anticoagulation was associated with an almost threefold increased risk of having major bleeding.
So sounds like business as usual. Just keep these folks on what they're on.
You stop it 5 days before, start it afterwards. That makes the treating regimen much simpler. This is really good news. This was really a conundrum, so I'm glad the study was done.
Indeed, and also since we're seeing so much more AFib. Finally then, sticking with the New England Journal of Medicine, let's take a look at something that seems like kind of a reach to me. When I read this study, I thought, okay, what about screening for occult cancer in people who present with deep venous thrombosis?
And the reason why this becomes an issue is there are certain conditions that predispose to deep vein thrombosis or pulmonary embolism, a clot in the leg or a clot in the lung. If people have had trauma, surgery, particularly in the leg, or prolonged immobility, it can also be an early sign of cancer. Up to 10% of individuals with unprovoked deep vein thrombosis actually over the next year will receive a diagnosis of cancer, and 60% of those within the first several months. So when someone presents with a deep vein thrombosis, should you have a full court press looking for occult cancer? To answer this question, the authors did a multi-center randomized control trial in Canada of over 850 individuals that had unprovoked deep vein thrombosis. And they randomized them to good history and physical, routine blood tests, mammography, pap smear, and if the individual is a man over the age of 40, a PSA. That's routine screening. The other half, they did that and they did a CT scan of the abdomen and pelvis looking for occult cancer. And what they discovered was that for people that had unprovoked DVT, about 3 to 4% had occult cancer. Almost all of those were picked up with routine screening. Furthermore, there was no difference between the time where the occult cancer was discovered. It was about 4 months in each group. So the screening with a CT scan didn't find occult cancer more commonly than the routine screening and didn't do it earlier. All it did was expose the patient to more radiation.
And cost a lot more.
Absolutely. This was a question that many of us as clinicians had when the patient says, why do I have a DVT? And there wasn't a reason. Do we just do the routine screening stuff or do I need to do a full body scan looking for cancer? So that's why this study is particularly important.
Good. So one more reason not to do a CT if you don't have to.
So which of these most interest you and what do you want to put on the blog, Elizabeth?
On the blog, I'm going to do the medical marijuana.
I think our listeners will enjoy looking at that primary data, but again, I'll remind them that all the articles are actually posted on the blog.
Indeed. Okay, so that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.